You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. Okay, we are in the room with Danny Reed.
I can't believe it. Mom calls me Danny.
No, clearly not only your mom now. And now hopefully half of CPC is going to be like, hi, Danny, I heard your podcast.
Yeah.
It's been like 2 months since you've been in this room.
It has. I had a little interruption that kept me out of the pulpit, and I wasn't able to be in here for this kind of interaction. So I'm glad to be back. Thanks for inviting me in.
So Kevin isn't here today, and neither is Rachel. And I'm wondering, first of all, do you take any offense to them being too busy to be here today?
My pride would probably say, no. I know that this was a last minute thing. You and I had busy schedules too, and we could only do this time.
But I wanted to villainize at least Kevin. So
okay. Yeah.
Thanks for not joining me in that.
Okay. Well, I'll try not to.
Hey,
Kevin would be here if he could. He really would. And so would Rachel.
You're so understanding, Danny. This is why people love you. Okay. So I want to start off with a question because you talked all about pride on Sunday during your sermon. And I was thinking, you know, most of us have, you know, the whole adage, pride comes before the fall. Sure. So most of us have some kind of moment where we thought we had it handled, or we thought we were hot stuff, or we thought we knew, and then something kind of slapped us upside the head. I'm curious if you have any moment that you'd be willing to share with us where that's happened to you, where you were kind of confronted with your own pride.
Well, if I sit here, I can come up with lots of them over my lifetime.
Or we could call your wife.
Yes, that she'd have some, ones I haven't even thought of because I put them in the back recesses of my mind. I would have to say, you know, when you've been in ministry for a while and you're up in front of people regularly and you need to communicate clearly and you kind of figure out how to do that. And
you would be considered a professional and an expert, right? I mean,
I would never say expert, but
why would you've been doing it for so long?
A veteran.
Yeah.
How about that? A veteran. Yeah. Seasoned. I like that. Seasoned. Okay. As a seasoned pastor, I believe it was two Christmas Eves ago, I was hosting at the services and I got up there to host and, you know, do my thing like I've done often over the years.
Hosting, no big deal. Just get up on
no
stage. You're not even have to give a sermon.
Yeah. I mean, we had our, you know, little announcement items we needed to use and do. And I'm up there and right before I turned people into greeting, what came out of my mouth stunned me as I said, Happy Easter.
At Christmas?
It was Christmas Eve. Yeah. And some of you on this call might remember that. Did he say Easter? And so I called somebody later and I was like, okay, you know, I should have this together. Why would I have said Easter? And I called a friend and I said, so in all the years you've been in church, have you ever heard anybody say Happy Easter on Christmas Eve? He said, oh, no.
Maybe you were thinking about how like the two big holidays are Christmas and Easter for churches, you know?
Yeah, my brain had to be firing. Maybe I was thinking ahead. I was already planning
for Easter. Yeah, well, it's better than you starting Christmas by saying like he is risen, which is still true on Christmas, but, you know, different emphasis.
Yeah, yeah, that would have... That would have really been, wow, he really thought it through.
he was steeped in his wrongness.
Exactly. He probably wrote that down. Yeah. How about you?
I think I have so many times when I have put my foot in my mouth because I have this horrible combination of ignorance and arrogance. So I think that I know something. And where this typically plays out in my life is like little bets. Like someone will be like, you want to bet? Like I'll be so convinced that I am right. And I have a very recent example for you. So I'm here with someone I'm doing a concert with, and we're doing a Simon and Garfunkel. I was telling you this, a Simon Garfunkel tribute show. Yeah. So anyway, we're in here rehearsing, and we have a friend who used to be here. He led worship, Brian. Yeah. And he's doing the cruise ship circuit. You know that, right? Yeah. So he's been on cruise ships now for, I don't know, collectively maybe 3 or 4 years. And as a musician on the cruise ship circuit, you have a massive repertoire, like massive. And he worked for a celebrity ship, so he had a lot of the older demographics, like not super old, but like, you know, boomers and stuff. Yeah. And so he knows a lot of
Simon and Garfunkel
stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I know he knows Simon Garfunkel, but he doesn't know this song. And we were talking about the song you don't even know, Baby Driver.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, there's no way he knows that song. And she's like, I'm telling you, I guarantee you he knows that song. And I was so convinced that I knew Brian that I was like, I'm willing to bet on this. You want to bet like $5 or something? And she said, no, we don't want to bet money. He goes, but I do. And to this day, I don't know how she came up with this bet. But she said, whoever loses has to call a friend that we both know and convince them that their arm is about to be amputated.
She just came up with that?
That's what just came off the top of her head. And prideful Brandon was still so convinced that I was right that I was like, I don't even care what the bet is. I'm not going to have to do it. So, and we called Brian and he knew the song.
Oh,
this was last week.
Oh, no.
So I called my friend. Oh my gosh. I called my friend John because you can't welch on a bet, Dan.
Okay.
And
thanks for that tip.
And I was like, how do I get him? I was thinking like through my best manipulation tactics. And I was like, how do I get him to believe this, but also have it not be super traumatizing? And I thought maybe if he.
It just sounds mean. It. kind of makes me feel icky.
So I got him to call me, and I think I just said something like, I think I just screwed up my life, and hoping that he would call me. And like a good friend, he called me, and so now I'm feeling super bad, but not bad enough to try to paint the picture. So I actually found on YouTube hospital noise background.
I can't believe you. I can't believe you.
I told you you'd be appalled by this. So I pulled up the hospital noise, and you can hear the beeping in the background. You hear hospital announcements happening and nurses rushing by and doctors and that kind of thing. And he called me, he goes, what's going on? And I was like, you know, I had this whole thing. Like,
what are you feeling right now?
Right in this moment,
no,
telling
you? When you were doing that, did you feel like I'm excited to pull this off, or really ashamed of yourself?
I think I was super excited to see if I could pull it off. And then when I started doing it, like when he called me and I realized that to him, he was calling a friend who he didn't know it was wrong. He just thought, then I started feeling really, really bad.
He's probably on like a date with his wife or something, you know, or
he was at work.
His kid with math.
So I basically convinced him. So I told him that I was running on the Bay Trail and that a truck came and knocked me into the marsh. And now I'm at Redwood City Kaiser and they're saying I might lose my arm. And he was like, oh man, you need me to come out. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. And it took him probably a good 3 minutes to laugh because he was so, I traumatized him. Isn't that horrible?
You manipulated him.
I'm feeling even more shame telling you this story now.
And the tens of listeners.
I never win when I bet people. I always lose. Like if you ever have an opportunity to bet with me, I always lose.
But you always bet though, right? You just, you just have to do it.
So, and I'm pretty sure that's pride, right?
I would think so. That's like like we talked about on Sunday. That's being off the line when that green light, being off the line first.
Which
I'm
do
win this time.
Which I do. Yeah, I put it in sport. My whole family knows about sport mode because you got to beat them off the line. even if it's like a 97 Civic, it doesn't matter. And when I was listening to your message, I also wasn't feeling great because pride is, it's hard. It's a thing that
it is. Every one of us struggles with it.
Yeah, but clearly some of us struggle more.
Well, maybe, but I think, you know, I think a big part of this, you know, we were talking earlier about, can you think of a time when, you know, you were prideful and, you know, I'm sitting there going, well, that requires self-awareness. And I think that's the thing, is reflection and honesty in order to even begin to look at it. And
anyway, so you talked about this this guy, Don, Pastor Don.
Oh, yes.
So he was probably one of your greatest influences spiritually, maybe not, you know, we were talking a little bit before, maybe not in training, but as you think about, you know, what shaped you. So as you look at Don, do you see pride at all? Like in his, did you ever see like that kind of pride in him or any great leader that you've ever followed?
Oh, when I go to, as you know, we'll go to training conferences now and then, and there'll be the expert that's on mm-hmm. the stage or the person that's done it all that had the resume. And, you know, I've learned over time, you know, just to not get too enthralled in what they say. And you find out later that there's a lot of stuff under the surface that yeah. they're not dealing with, you know, which is for all of us. There's things that we ignore and it, you know, when you're told you're great enough, you know, it messes with your head. Mm-hmm. And I fortunately haven't had that happen to me. God's protected me from that.
Dan, you're just fine. You seasoned professional, you.
But Don, no, I never heard him talk about his past ministry and any sort of I miss this or look what I gave up. It was just this is who I am, this is who God's called me to be, and this is where significance is found. You know, he was so comfortable and confident in himself that he because he was mature and he knew what was the most important thing, you know, and that was caring for his family. Caring for his wife.
Yeah.
And everything else just sort of filtered out, you know, from there. And I didn't see that. I didn't know him a lot of years. You know, it wasn't a long, I mean, it was like 5 years
yeah.
when we would meet for that, you know, for about 5 years. But it just, I never saw that. And I never saw him saying anything about like missing out on anything or back in the day I used to do. You
yeah.
know,
yeah. Reliving the yeah, glory days.
Yeah, right.
These were the
right.
glory days.
Right. And yes, they were. And he's just ministering to the little flock that God gave him. And he turned that ministry over, you know, after he passed. He turned it over to somebody in the church who I believe is still there, you know, many years later.
Yeah, I when you were talking, I was thinking of this mentor that I had named Bill in junior high and the youth group that I was in, and my dad was the youth pastor, and he was doing this revolutionary new thing called cell groups.
Oh,
do you remember cell groups?
Ralph Neighbor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And so, you know, it basically kind of like small, what we yeah, call small groups yeah. now. And so he would get a bunch of junior high boys together and pair them with a leader. And we would meet with that guy. And so we got Bill. His big, I never knew till way years later what a big deal he was in Chicago in the architect world. Like he's designed and seen built like some of the most popular buildings in Chicago. Hmm. Did the University of Iowa Hospital, all that kind of stuff. We never knew that he was just our junior high leader, and so we would go out to his house. And man, I just think about like there's still lessons back then that I can still remember. Him teaching us and him taking us under his wing and that kind of thing, and letting us come and eat him out of a house and home. I mean, and he was the first guy that popped into my head. And when I think about those leaders that have had that huge impact, I never really I've definitely had prideful leaders in my life, but those aren't the ones that had the huge impact, which is really interesting because I've also worked for a lot of different churches, and some of there's some leaders that I've worked with or whatever, that do kind of have that pride thing. And I realized that for a while I would respect it because that's a lot what the world looks like. Like there's this vibe in the business world that like you want to have that sense of pride, right? Especially in sales. Like if you're in sales, you want to have that, you know, a lot of the guys like want to have that. I can dominate. I can handle any conversation. I'm the man, and you want to go in with that confidence, but you juxtapose that next to what you said, which is the greatest in God's kingdom are the humble servants. Like that would just not fly at a sales organization. And yet you see these leaders, in church world who lead with that mentality. And I found that those people, those prideful leaders, they always manage to find a following. Have you seen that?
People look at that leader and say, if I just do what they do, I will have that kind of success. And, it's a blending of the world with the church,
yeah.
You know, in terms of, well, what is true success? Well, it's taking what is truly success in the marketplace and saying, well, we can reproduce that in the church. And I've seen that over and over again in my experiences where, you know, we kind of, you know, embrace that, you know, in different ministries I've been in, and it never works out.
Mm.
It never works out right. And even in the ones that are leading, you just realize there's something else going on there, and it seems to eventually come out, and you would look at it and say, man, I have all these books by this guy, and now that I know what he's really like,
yeah,
I don't even want to give him away. You know, I'm going to throw him. You know, it's like you can't even use their principles anymore because it's just kind of ruined.
It's such a bizarre thing to me that, and Katie and I were just talking about this, that she just recently started listening to some podcast about how cults, like they're studying how cults are started. They talk about, you know, you have some charismatic guy that has a little bit of woo and he always finds it. And it just it corroborated this idea that if you have enough woo and you can use spiritual, you know, a little bit of spiritual knowledge and twist it, you can always try to get people. So pride, there is something, I guess what I'm trying to say is there is kind of something attractive about pride. And I can't quite figure out what that is, why those people always find followers.
Yeah. When I think of people that draw those large crowds, they're being told often what they want to hear. Like are you going to draw a large crowd if the topic of your conference is die to self? You know, it's
die to self conference.
Yeah. The die to self conference.
DTS.
Yeah. It's not gonna draw. And it's also painted in such a way that, well, this leads to more people, and more people, that means more potential conversions, or more money, that means more, that's more we can spend on ministries and overseas. And there's always a rationale. But in reality, is it drawing us back? I think we pointed out in the sermon that how do you fight pride is you got to walk really close to Jesus.
Mm.
We can't fight it any other way. We got to walk close to Jesus and then allow our ambitions to be tempered in that. I mean, we all have ambitions, and you know, it's an ambition to die to self, and that's a good ambition. But when we let our ambitions run amok out from under the authority of Christ, then that's when we run into trouble. And so anything we do in ministry has to begin with my relationship with Christ.
Mm.
And I got to just be leaning into him continually. And I got to have people around me that can speak honestly into my life, you know, where I can open up my heart and others will open up their hearts about me and be able to have tough conversations with me.
So what would you say to someone that, maybe after your message is looking introspectively at themselves and saying, maybe I do have some pretty strong ambition, and maybe it is forming pride. What would be their next step? How do they identify it? How do they look at what they're doing? How do they change it? Would you have any kind of next step for a person like that?
It's self. Where am I selfish? Where am I looking out for me first? Don't rationalize it. I know people that have been very successful in their businesses who will say, I'm doing it for someone else. Mm. But in reality, they forfeited their kids or forfeited their marriage. It's always been, I've always been doing this for you, not for me. But in reality, that wasn't the case. And so it just takes introspection, I think, and looking at different settings in your life where, like we talked about, where am I at work? Do I have to win at work? Do I have to get ahead? Am I always the hero of my stories? Thinking about how I interact with people, and am I rooting for somebody else? Can I cheer someone else's victory?
Oh, that's a good one.
If I'm in a room and they're going around and they're giving accolades for different things, and wow, I got bypassed, or they didn't say much about me, you know. And okay, how am I going to process that? And am I going to realize, well, this isn't my audience here. My audience is God. You know, I'm doing it for Him. So I think it's hard. It's really a difficult thing, and pride is the number one sin. That is where Satan comes in all throughout the scriptures and all in our lives. That's the number one. I think anything, there was a quote I didn't use. Yeah, C.S. Lewis, every other sin is like a flea bite in comparison to pride.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, go down your list of sins. So it all begins there, and that's where Satan really works. So it's the pride of life.
Yeah. Charlie and I, my little 8-year-old that read scripture on Sunday, we had the weekend together, which is why she was with me on Sunday morning early, why she was able to read scripture. But Katie and Olivia were off at doing volleyball. And so we had like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday together, just doing whatever. And so on Saturday we were just riding bikes around, and she, you know, would direct us to another place, and we'd ride bikes to that place. So we go to this little park in Redwood Shores, and we're just hanging out there. And I notice that in the back on this little table, this like picnic bench, there is, there's like this little set of sunglasses on this bench that's no one's there. The park is busy, but no one is going back to that section. So there's just so I go up and look at it while Charlie's playing, and it's like sparkly, brand new Ray-Bans, like beautiful Ray-Bans. And I have this pattern in my life. About every 4 years, I convince myself to buy a nice set of sunglasses. And then after about a year, I lose it or break it. And then spend 3 more years with cheap, junky sunglasses.
And a penance.
And then I do another set of Ray-Bans.
Yeah.
But the last set of Ray-Bans that I had, I know they got stolen. I like left them somewhere, and I went back after like, I don't know, 5 minutes, something like that.
They were gone.
And they were gone. And no one had any idea where they were.
That happened here at church?
No, it happened at the Bay Club.
Oh.
Would you believe it? Anyway, so at church.
I was waiting for you to get that.
I think I saw you with those, Dan.
You see somebody walking. Hey, he's got glasses.
And how do you prove their years anyway? You know, like I didn't carve my initials in them.
Yeah.
To the point where I've even considered coming up with like a little mini tracking device so that you can label your sunglasses like with your iPhone. Anyway.
Oh, okay.
So I'm looking at these, and I'll be honest, man, it was a real temptation. Like I could sense myself. Now I don't steal, but I could feel myself saying, "How many sunglasses have you gotten stolen?" This is just what happens. This is just what you do in the world. If you see sunglasses, you pick them up.
And somebody else is going to come take them that is less worthy in it than I, you know.
So. Exactly. I was starting to go down that trail. Less worthy? Might as well be me.
Yeah, for sure.
So I could feel like these little thoughts sneaking in. And so I kind of panicked and ran over to the closest people to me and just told them that their sunglasses, they both had sunglasses on, so I knew it wasn't theirs, but at least now if these two people know, now if I go take the sunglasses, they're like, "Hey, wait, you just said you found those. Are you stealing those?" So that was like my defense. And Charlie, you know, the 8-year-old is just sitting here watching this whole interaction.
Yeah.
And like, she didn't know why I was telling him. She just assumed that was the most normal thing in the world. And so I, you know, used it as a teaching moment. And I was like, "Charlie, how easy would it be just to take those sunglasses and then we'd have a really nice brand new set of sunglasses?" Like, are they expensive? Are they more than $10?
Yeah.
I'm like, "Yeah, they're probably like $200. Oh my God. You know, she was blown away. And I was like, "Yeah, you could just take them, but that would be stealing." And I'm like, "Do you want to?" And so the pattern that I've been repeating with her over the last year or so is, what kind of world do you want to live in? And do you want to live in a world where if you leave your really nice sunglasses on a picnic bench, when you come back, they're there? Or do you want to live in a world where you know if you leave something, it's gone? Oh, I want to live in the other world. So, but I feel like that simple kind of thing is why I feel like we don't. And you talked a little bit about the destructive nature of pride. And I feel like we don't acknowledge, like even when you said the C.S. Lewis quote just now about, you know, that everything else is a flea bite, I feel like that it doesn't really sink in. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of talk a little bit about the destructive ripple effect of pride and how we kind of don't maybe give it the credit it's due.
Sure. Well, in the text, what comes out pretty clearly, which was a really colorful text to preach, is the way the disciples argue amongst themselves as to who is the greatest.
Who's the greatest?
I am. No, you are.
I remember when we had that argument last week, Dan.
So, you know, he's letting them just sink deeper and deeper into the muck before he brings them out. But they're having that argument. And, you know, you had the three that went up on the Mount of Transfiguration. And so they probably thought they were the greatest. And then you had, you know, James and John's mother getting involved, literally getting down on her knees in order to beg Jesus, it says, that each of her sons have a position, one on the right and one on his left in heaven. And, you know, so again, it creates tension. What were they doing the night he was betrayed? Is they were arguing about it before Jesus got down and washed their feet to show him what a, you know, a selfless, what, it's a servant. Your greatness is in serving. So division. It causes division. You know, when we seek unity on our team at work or on our team here at the church, you know, we want to build each other up. And, you know, we need to have the attitude of John the Baptist in that, you know, I must decrease so they can increase. And I see that in, even in my age now, as I'm, you know, into my 60s, early 60s with ministry, is we got to be thinking a lot about the younger ones and moving them up and developing them. Well, we need to give them slots. We need to give them opportunities for that too, to grow in that. So that's one aspect of it. The other is, you know, God created us for a certain purpose, and he wants us to have significance. And he knows better than we know what we really want. We think we know what we want, but he knows what we want. And if we're behaving selfishly because we think it will get us what we want, the reality is it does not get us what we want. He has what we want, and his path is what we really want. So we're diminishing the image of God in us when we're prideful and we're really not getting satisfied. And, you know, when we talk about the world's way of rewarding, it's a temporary feel-good thing, but ultimately we all know that it's hollow.
Yeah, it doesn't last.
Yeah, it's hollow. And then that last aspect comes out with when he illustrates with that little child. And he said, this little child doesn't brings cuteness into the room, I'm sure, but he didn't talk about that, but doesn't bring accomplishment or greatness or any real value to produce anything as a child. And then he says, you need to receive one of these, because when you receive these children, when you love and you care for the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, and it could be an elderly person, you're receiving me. So what he's saying there is we miss out on something God wants to give us if we're so prideful that we're not thinking about serving and serving others that are less.
That can't give you anything back.
Can't give you anything back. There's nothing in return. But in reality, he's saying there is, and that's more of Jesus, and then more of his Father is what the passage is saying. So we walk closer to Jesus when we're serving. There's something we'll miss out on. We call it spiritual growth too. Like, how can we really grow spiritually if we don't serve others and have the right attitude? I don't think we can. I think there's going to be a diminishment in our growth unless we have an attitude of service.
Yeah,
I'm going to do a talk here for our community group leaders here in the next couple weeks, and I'm going to use your small group as an example, and have
Carolyn.
Have Carolyn come and share about how their group serves in order to, you know, cast a little more vision for our other groups in terms of what this can be if they serve together.
Yeah.
So pretty cool.
It's something that I think about a lot, having little kids, and how do you instill that this world needs to be bigger than you. Like our practice labs, Justin Chow was talking about that, and how, you know, we're not meant to live for ourselves, that we're not created for that. And so when we exist for ourselves only, which is kind of what happens when you are growing up, if no one teaches you to exist for someone outside of yourself, you kind of exist for yourself. And so, you know, looking at our kids who think that our life, you know, revolves around them, because in a way for the first part of their life, it kind of did, thinking through how can we help our kids understand, you know, and like you're saying, opportunities to go out and serve people that aren't going to be able to repay you in some kind of monetary way. It's not going to be a transaction. It's just you loving them. So I'm always looking for opportunities to do that with my two girls.
But your sunglasses example is perfect. They'll never forget that. You'd shared earlier that when you were in junior high, you had a junior high leader, and you know, you were discipled or mentored, cared for by him, but he was quite an achiever in the world in his particular profession, but it left a mark on you that here he is sitting with, you know, a bunch of, you know, mixed up junior hires, you know, boys. And, and he did it 'cause he saw the value of that. Most people say, you don't have time for this. Go design another big building. You know,
The one prideful thing he did that I'll never forget. We were all, you know, we grew up to be high schoolers, and we finally got our license and stuff. And he lived outside of, this is in Iowa. So he lived like kind of outside of town, and we were messing around whatever we were doing. And we got to his house, like, I don't know, maybe an hour late or something, you know, really late. And he was messed. He was mad. He was mad. You could tell he wanted us to understand the gravity of us making someone wait. And so he had us all write down a bunch of figures that we didn't know what they were. He was like, I want you to write down, you know, this 150. Okay. Now I want you to write down how late you were and whatever. So basically we figured out that he was giving us his hourly rate on what he charges clients and how much, if he was going to bill us, we would owe him for making him wait for an hour. And we were all these, like, you know, junior high kids in Iowa just like couldn't even fathom the amount of money. And he wasn't,
think about how many Abba Zaba bars I could buy for that.
Oh yeah. I mean, at that point,
Slurpees.
I could fill half my gas tank for $5. So, yeah. You know, his hourly rate was, was astronomical. But something that you said, you know, the whole, the kid thing, Dan, I remember, before I had kids, it was, I thought it was a funny, endearing thing, but I would always tell Katie, I don't like babies. And she's like, how do you not like babies? They're this cute little cuddly, you know, little worm, you just glow worm, you just hug, and they just smell good all the time. I'm like, no, they don't do anything. They just lay there. They can't even hold their own head up. And we have this big joke about how, you know, don't like babies. We have to take care of them. But, you know, at the root of it, I do think there's a piece of me that if you're not productive to me, you don't matter. And you see that a lot actually with kids. And now that I have kids and I'm thinking about how they're growing up, and I pay attention now when we're in a group where we're hanging out with children, I pay attention to how adults treat children. And when they treat them like they don't exist or they don't matter, it says something. You know, it says like, oh, you know, you're too busy to care about a child that doesn't have any, add any value to your life, which is what I loved. If any of you guys went to the practice labs on either Sunday, it's so beautiful because it was a multi-generational experience. You had people there that were, you know, in their 70s, and you had people there that were, you know, in single digits, and they were all communicating about how we find rest and how we find what does Sabbath mean to us and how do we find joy. And it's like, that's the kind of, back to the Charlie example, that's the kind of world I want to live in. The world where, and we're blown away by how much we learn from those little kids, the people that we don't think can add much value.
So there's your spiritual growth as you think through that in how we treat kids. You know, you mentioned something earlier about the junior high leader and what he showed you, the lesson about making weight and making him wait. And I thought about that in terms of this understanding of people that we serve that are the most needy and learning how to do that well. And I think we just need a lot of wisdom and discernment, because when we serve people, are we doing what we think is serving, and they're not changing or getting better or learning. And I struggle with that. Mm-hmm. I struggle with that as a pastor is, okay, am I enabling them?
Like they don't want to get better.
Yeah. 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 And they just want the attention or the whatever, the material thing, you know, the help. And how do we really help people? You know, there is a level of accountability in our service that we've got to figure out, you know, and we got to do that. And we can get a lot of pride too. I've helped you such and such.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're just, but there's understanding. There's a lot of wisdom, in terms of needed in order to understand that greatness of serving. Cause Jesus always, you know, he held people accountable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, he talked really tough, honest truth when it was needed, and made people feel uncomfortable that were too comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, when people were uncomfortable, he comforted them. But it's just that's part of ministry and trying to figure that out. And, you know, you said what he did was prideful, and it, who knows? It probably, you know, it could have, we don't know his heart. It might have been, but it actually taught you a lesson, didn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember. I don't remember what he made per hour. I just remember it was a lot.
A lot of Dairy Queen.
You know, back then, it could have been, you know, a little amount. It would have impressed
me. Yeah.
I was working at Ace Hardware at the time for, I think, $5.15 an hour.
Were you really? Okay, what year was that? Yeah, you were in junior high and you're working at Ace Hardware?
Well, no, because we grew up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Right, so I was working at Ace Hardware when I was 14, though. 14 years old.
What did you sell at Ace Hardware? So you know a lot about hardware, huh?
I knew nothing.
Okay.
It was embarrassing. I just wandered around.
Sell little Hummels in the front.
I knew how to work the register, so you know, okay. I'd check people out, but then people would be like, hey, can I get this plumbing thing? And I'd be like, oh, let me find the plumbing aisle. And people would mess with me. I think I've said it on this podcast before, where they'd ask me for, you know, blinker fluid. So I'd take them to automotive and be like, it's got to be somewhere around here. You know, here's the light bulbs, you know. Yeah, but, you know, I'll never forget, Dan, this preacher that talked about, you know, he kind of boiled down. He took a liberty here, but he boiled down, you know, what Jesus is, you know, his two commandments into a question that we could ask ourselves as almost an alignment question that I think could align us with how to manage that tension that you just talked about of how do we show up for people and also make sure we have boundaries. And well, he said the question that we need to ask, maybe you've heard this, what does love require of me? And when you go into every single situation, that's really the question that Jesus asks, because it's easy for us to make a policy and this is how I treat everybody and this is what I do in every situation. It's much harder to go based on a principle like that, which is everybody has a different need and everybody has a different response. But if we're asking that, it's hard to ask that question, what does love require of me, with pride? Because most of the time, whatever love requires of you is not, it's not for you. It's for them. So, yeah, I try to keep that question at the front of my mind.
What does love require of me? You know, it's that idea of mercy and justice and humility, all of that. So I think it's great, Brandon. I think it's really a good, because that is a principle. It's like, how do you argue with that? How would you, if somebody is questioning your way of living, and you say, well, here's the question I ask, what does love require of me? Now, you could debate what the answer is, and that's fine, you know, but answer it, you know. It's not right. It would be inappropriate not to answer that question.
And I think it's honestly less of a debate than we think it is. It's a high bar, but I think it's simpler. Like if you use the Ray-Ban example, you know, and we're at the park. Well, what does love require of me in this situation? I mean, ideally, maybe love requires me to go further and do some investigation, figure out who was there earlier.
Gotta get off the stage. You know, but what we got to watch out for in that is, okay, so, you know, my wife and I are talking, answering that question, and I think my love, my act of love is better than hers.
This is what love requires of me, sorry. Like, oh, really?
Love requires more of me than it does of you.
Yeah, maybe it breaks down a little bit.